Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
This is special coverage from WBUR in Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook. Algeria was supposed to be an example to its Arab neighbors of how a country could transition out of colonial rule to a vibrant, multi-ethnic democracy. That is, until Islamic fundamentalism took hold, democratic elections were canceled, and terror reigned for a decade. This hour, Algeria, a cautionary tale of all that can go wrong when democratic reform meets Islamic rage. But first, the U.S. Capitol building may have been spared a direct hit on September 11th, but the terrorist attacks have sent shockwaves through the congressional agenda. Issues once considered front and center are now firmly shelved, while previously low-priority topics have landed center stage. With Congress adjourned for its Thanksgiving break, I spoke earlier today with David Hawkins, news editor at the Congressional Quarterly, about Capitol Hill post-September 11th. I asked him what the overall effect of the attacks has been on the congressional agenda.
I would say that it has turned the congressional agenda that existed before the 11th into a non-operative document, and it's been completely replaced by a new set of items. Some things that were on the back burner were thrown to the front burner, and a lot more things that seem to be on the front burner are off the burner.
Of the things that were on the front burner, what's been significantly sidelined by the war on terrorism?
More than anything else, what has happened is Congress just has only so many things that it can concentrate on at once. So some things that they thought they were going to have time to tackle this year, like the Patients' Bill of Rights legislation and the perhaps campaign finance legislation and perhaps legislation to overhaul the election system.
So those three have fallen off. Social Security?
Social Security, I would say, already the perpetual mess that it is. There seemed to be some fighting chance that Bush's proposal to allow some investments of Social Security taxes in the markets might get considered seriously this year. But it would require sort of a time in the political calendar where there was nothing else more pressing to go on.
And that's vanished.
Campaign finance reform, which for the first time ever, the Senate had actually passed a bill this year. The House had not, but there was some talk that the very complicated amount of pressure that needed to be applied to have that happen could happen this fall. That's vanished, at least until next year. And similarly, overhauling the election system, which a year ago, if we can all remember back that far to the last,
the uproar over the presidential election.
Over the contested presidential election on the Florida ballots. Everybody said at the start of this year the conventional wisdom was if Congress does nothing else, it will figure out a way to make sure Florida never happens again. The momentum for that, which had sort of waxed and waned all year, is now in a period of waning, and at least until next year.
Other issues have been propelled forward with a speed no one would have guessed by September 11.
Absolutely true. There was almost no talk this year about any kind of changes to the criminal code. But, of course, September 11th gave rise to this very wide-ranging and aggressive push by the Bush administration to tighten criminal laws and expand the powers of law enforcement agents to combat terrorism. Very few people thought that a move to overhaul the immigration system was going to see any legs this year. And in fact, now it has. One of the proposals that, unless you lived in Washington and thought about immigration policy, you probably never would have heard of, was the idea of taking the INS and turning it into two different agencies, one to do law enforcement and one to help immigrants.
Now John Ashcroft is talking a lot about that. What's the point of that?
There's something of a fox guarding the hen house complaint about the current system, which is that you have one agency that is both, in some ways, both a social services agency and a law enforcement agency, that it makes the INS good at neither, and that by separating them into two agencies, you'd have a chance to sort of have two distinct sets of priorities under two distinct bureaucracies.
Mm-hmm. How do the folks in Congress feel about this rapid change in priorities?
Well, it's interesting. One answer is it all depends on who you ask. There are several people who have been backbenchers for years because they've been working on areas that hadn't got much attention, i.e. terrorism, are suddenly on everybody's get list.
For example?
People you might not have ever heard of, people like Senator Bob Bennett of Utah, who was this very hardworking but sort of quiet guy whose last big project was helping Congress ward off the Y2K problem. And after that problem came and went away without too much fuss, he started thinking about terrorism. And now suddenly he's on everybody's mm-hmm. list of people to talk to. A guy named Pat Roberts from Kansas, who was an agriculture expert for the first 20 years of his life in Congress. And then last year, a little bit as a lark, he got himself on the Armed Services Committee and a subcommittee on terrorism and non-traditional military threats came open, and he decided to grab it and see what he could do with it. And now that's gone from being sort of nobody knew it to everybody wants to talk to him.
Who's unhappy and invisible now?
Well, I would say some of the people who might be unhappy, just to circle back to the idea of things that were on, anybody who was a front burner issue guy whose issue is now on the back burner, somebody like John McCain. Just think about John McCain. Until September 11th, he was inundated with requests for other Republicans to come campaign for him. Now, with the war underway, nobody really needs McCain to come to their districts anymore. Everybody wants Rudy Giuliani, who's suddenly gone from being the Republicans other Republicans thought was not really a Republican to sort of the poster boy for compassionate Republicanism.
And finally, what's likely to dominate the congressional agenda once Congress people come back from the Thanksgiving recess?
Well, there are really only two things that Congress has to do. One is to finish the budget for the year the budget year that began on October 1st. They need to decide how much they're going to spend on the war on terrorism, both at home and abroad. And the president doesn't want to spend a dollar over $20 billion. Many Democrats and some Republicans, especially those from New York, think that amount is inadequate and want something closer to $35 to $40 billion. And then the only other sort of must-do thing in December is this economic stimulus package, which is a real mess because the Republicans who run the House and the Democrats who narrowly run the Senate have very, very different ideas about how the economy might be stimulated by about $100 billion of federal intervention. And the president himself has not really weighed in with the kind of direction that will be needed to untangle this mess and actually get a compromise through.
David Hawkins is news editor at the Congressional Quarterly in Washington, D.C. Algeria has seen just about the worst in national strife. In the past 50 years, Algerians have overthrown their colonial rulers, suffered decades of repressive secular government, watched the rise to power of Islamic fundamentalists, and endured extreme bloody violence. In 1992, 30 years after winning independence from France in a brutal civil war, it appeared that fundamentalists would win the nation's first democratic elections and cancel democracy. Instead, the government canceled voting, triggering a decade of terrorism and repression. In the past 10 years, 100,000 people have been killed in Algeria in terrorist attacks and government reprisals. As the world considers political reform in Afghanistan and the Middle East, what lessons can it take from Algeria? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-TALK. That's 1-800-423-8255. We're joined from Milwaukee, Wisconsin this evening by Philip Naylor. He's a professor of history at Marquette University and author of France and Algeria, A History of Decolonization and Transformation. Good evening, Professor Philip Naylor.
Good evening. How are you?
Fine. Thanks for joining us. And joining us from the studios of Vermont Public Radio is our news analyst, Jack Beattie, a senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom.
Philip Naylor, everyone is looking at the Middle East now, and I guess that extends right on over into North Africa, at Islamic countries who have a lot of bitterness and anger in their populations, looking at the governments that are in charge there, wondering what the future may bring and if there's not some way to bring democratic reform that would share the wealth and the power in those countries more effectively, perhaps be a less fertile breeding ground for terrorism. The story of Algeria appears instructive in a grim way here. We'd be grateful if you'd take us back and help us understand what happened in Algeria a bit. Just start walking us into the stories in a way that we might see it as a model or not a model for what lies ahead there and in other countries.
Okay, sure. Thank you. We have to go back, I believe, to the Algerian War of Independence against France, where we had the development of the National Liberation Front. This front, ostensibly, was a unified effort to bring in every nationalist tendency in Algeria. And for the first couple of years of this conflict, which lasted from 54 to 62, this idea of inclusion seemed to work. But as the war raged on, the National Liberation Front became fratricidal. You had tendencies within the movement itself to kill off the elite, members of the elite where there were differences, and it became more of an organization which was exclusivist rather than inclusionist. And the result of all of this was when the country did gain its independence in 1962, you had a government which was one which included an exclusive elite rather than an inclusive elite. And this elite then would dominate Algeria until 1988 and establish a system based on socialism, based ostensibly on Islamism, but it essentially was a pretty secular socialist state.
Philip Mailer, we know after that point comes the big clash when the elections were scheduled and then canceled. But before we get there, what about this exclusive elite? Is it a parallel in any dimension to elites we see in other countries in the region now who are concerned about their grasp on power?
Well, it was an elite, which, by the way, is still in power today, which is a civilian military elite. And there are certainly other examples of that in the Middle East today. As a matter of fact, I'd have to say in the last couple of years, this elite has practically refashioned a type of government that was in Algeria in the pre-1988 period. And I mentioned 1988 because those were the riots which began the democratization process in Algeria.
So are you thinking of Egypt when you think of a comparable regime or some other country?
Sure, Egypt would be comparable.
Now, in 1988, the democratic agenda came onto the table, and it quickly came into competition with an Islamic fundamentalist agenda.
Right. You had the riots in October 88, which brought a flurry of reforms, including the amended constitution in February 1988, and then in July, I'm sorry, February 1989, and then in July 89, you had legislation which allowed for a pluralist political system to take hold, and parties could then subscribe for legitimacy, and one of those parties was the Islamic Salvation Front, and it was accepted as a legitimate party.
Now, they won some early elections, but when it came to the big general election, at the last minute, the plug was pulled. Why was that?
Well, it was pulled because of a fear by this exclusivist civilian military elite that they would not only take over the government but also change the nature of the country itself, making it an Islamist republic and one in which they themselves, that is the traditional elite, would lose not only power but also a lot of its privileges which would be social and economic.
Jack Beatty, as you listen to this story, and we're going to dive more into it after a break, but what do you hear that seems to inform the thinking or might inform the thinking of lots of people are doing now about political reform in the Middle East?
Well, we've heard again and again about how Egypt and Saudi Arabia, to stop there, have a very similar profile to Algeria before these riots, before the canceling of elections. And for both places, people are saying, you've got to make reforms, you've got to change. And yet when you look at the repressive records of each of them, it's striking how much it looks like an Algerian profile. In Saudi Arabia, there's no freedom of association, no freedom of expression, no political parties, no independent media. The internet is watched carefully. Capital punishment is given for the minor events. There's all sorts of cruelty to dissidents and to anybody who shows any sorts of difference. Recently, 25 transvestites were given 2,600 lashes apiece for simply being who they were. And this is our great ally there. There's a state religious police committee to promote virtue and prevent vice, rather like the Taliban. So you've got this, and you've got lots of unemployment. You've got lots of university-trained young men with nothing to do. And the only place to register their feeling, they can't participate in politics, is in Islamic radicalism. It looks a lot like Algeria.
Jack Beatty, Philip Naylor, hang on. We're going to come back and look at the story of Algeria and how it may help us think about the challenges that lie ahead for political progress in the Middle East. You can join the conversation by calling 1-800 1-800-423-TALK. That's 1-800-423-8255. Where is the future hope of democratic reform in the Middle East? Where do you see hope today? You can also join us online at WBUR.org. Click on Special Coverage Forums. I'm Tom Ashbrook. You're listening to Special Coverage from WBUR Boston. This is Special Coverage from WBUR Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook. We're talking tonight about Algeria and its lessons for political evolution in the Middle East. We have allies in the Middle East that are not necessarily pretty governments, autocracies, plutocracies, a rich few at the top, and poor folks who are not happy underneath. What does Algeria tell us about the path that might lie ahead and where we don't want to stub our toe? We're joined this evening by Professor Philip Naylor. He's a professor of history at Marquette University in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, and author of France and Algeria, A History of Decolonization and Transformation. Here's the question. Are you prepared for the United States to support democratic reform if it raises risks of Islamic fundamentalists taking charge? Can we afford to invite the upheaval that might come with democratic reform in the Middle East? Or can we afford not to? Philip Naylor, if you'd be good enough, take us right up to the time of these democratic elections. What was the world's response? Did they support the movement towards democracy in Algeria? And when the military civilian government pulled the plug in the face of Islamic fundamentalism, how did the world respond?
Well, the growth of democracy in Algeria was certainly a surprise to many observers, and France in particular, which has very close relations with Algeria, was pretty astonished by the situation. People were very encouraged to see democratization happen. They were happy to see different longtime nationalists return to Algeria and set up their own parties. Everything looked really quite well. And I wanted to point out that when you look at the Islamic Salvation Front, we have to be very careful when looking at these Islamist parties to not necessarily assume that they're going to turn radical. The Islamic Salvation Front was really quite moderate. Its goals were moderate. It attested to some type of political pluralism. And again, I'm somewhat hesitant to necessarily use Algeria as perhaps some type of a paradigm for the rest of the Islamic world. This is a world which is on a grayscale, essentially, rather than being something that's black and white.
Well, you've raised an interesting point. We don't want to push the parallel any further than it works. That's, I guess, what we're examining here tonight. But when you say the Islamic Salvation Front was not necessarily radical, in that case, why was the government in power so afraid of it? Simply because it was going to win? It was portrayed to the world as a fundamentalist threat, was it not?
Well, it was to many people. At the same time, you had a government which had lost the confidence of the people. You had a government which lost all of its credibility, given the severe repression of the October 1988 riots. You had little services to the people, while the Islamic Salvation Front was providing local services, at the point that they just overwhelmed the local elections in June 1990.
But wasn't the tag of radicalism the excuse or the rationale that was used by the government to put off democratic reform? They said if this Islamic party wins, they will end democracy instead of embracing it. Isn't that right?
Well, that's what they did. That's what they said. Of course, we can look back and speculate on all of that. But as soon as the government also began to arrest and place into detention camps, including camps in the Sahara, Islamist supporters of the Islamic Salvation Front, that was a particular call to arms. And then we began in 1992 the terrible fitna. Fitna, an Arabic word meaning trial of a nation or just trial discord, and that occurred, and of course 100,000 deaths, as you mentioned earlier.
So we had this awful kind of self-fulfilling prophecy. The government in power labeled the Islamic Party as radical, denied it access to democratic process, which turned the party radical, and then we got terror and reprisal.
I mean, there's nobody who can really argue and say that the democratic process in Algeria was not flawed. It certainly was flawed. The elections in December 1991 certainly can be looked at with a very critical eye. But at the same time, this was a fledgling democracy. And many people believe that to categorically claim that the Salvation Islamic Front was bent on creating an Islamic Republic, well, this may not necessarily have been true, given the fact that they had to deal with a very powerful institution, and that was the Algerian army.
Jack Beatty, we've heard again and again on this program from people saying if you don't eventually get to a better political systems in these countries, you're never going to solve the problem, the tension, the anger. But that raises this tough question for the United States or any country that would look at, to support democratic reform. Should countries hold elections? Should the United States support elections in countries knowing that Islamicists will win and may not support democracy themselves?
Well, that's certainly a tough call. And, of course, our government, if, correct me if I'm wrong, Professor, but I think our government in 1992 took that line and basically supported the Algerian government in not holding these elections out of just that sort of fear.
That was a fear, yeah.
Yeah, but of course, a fear heavily surrounded by the propaganda of the Algerian government. We, as you say, it was a proposition that wasn't tested. You know, democracy really doesn't have to agree to abolish itself. I mean, the classic case would be the elections that brought in Adolf Hitler. Suppose the Weimar Republic had said, wait a minute, the Nazi Party has grown with each election. Because of the splintering of all other parties, they look like they're going to get a majority in this one. We are simply calling the election off because these fellows want to stop democracy, and democracy is not a suicide pact. The whole world would have been better off. I think that this is a tough question. It isn't just clear that democracies have to, abolish themselves in their own name. There's an absurdity about that.
But Jack Beatty, these are hardly democracies, though, abolishing themselves.
No,
they're autocracies. They're plutocracies.
Yep.
Philip Naylor, is there a way out of this knot?
Well, the only way out of it is to basically head toward inclusion, and that would include the Islamic Salvation Front in some type of discussion. You have two other leaders. One is in house arrest, and the other one is in prison. I think that for a resolution, to this particular crisis, they must be consulted. It must be brought into the discussion. There's another group that has splintered off from this very violent Islamist group, which is the Armed Islamic Group. But there's another group that is a rather recent phenomenon, and that is a group that seems to be less, well, interested certainly in destabilizing Algeria, but also seems to have that international dimension to its terrorism, which, of course, is something that we're quite fearful of given the events of 9/11.
We're looking at the Algerian example in the difficult march of North Africa and the Middle East, the Islamic world, toward democratic reform. And here's the question. Are you prepared for the United States to support democratic reform even if it raises risks of Islamic fundamentalists taking charge and maybe not embracing democracy themselves? We're at 1-800-423-8255. Charles is on the line. Welcome, Charles.
Oh, hello. How are you, Tom?
And, well, thanks.
I'm glad that you have Jack Beatty on because he's usually reasonable. I don't understand what the other guy is saying. But I just wanted to bring this discussion back a little bit to the legacy of what has happened there, including the whole idea that the people who were visionary, people like Ahmed Ben Bella, mm-hmm. Suffered the same fate that Patrice Lumumba faced in the Congo. That is, at that time, the United States and the Western powers weren't ready for the kind of democracy that the people of Algeria and the people of Congo had chosen.
Mm-hmm.
So I think when you're talking about the readiness of the United States to accept any kind of, whatever political system that happens in these countries, it's almost a non-question.
Well, we take that it sounds patronizing. It seems like the wrong question to be asking.
Of course.
But Charles,
Jack can back me up on this. I think with Robert Kaplan's piece in December Atlantic on Samuel Huntington, we know that democracies cannot develop in the way that United States want or in England or even what has happened in South Africa. I think every case is unique. And I think the Algerian case, my parents were Pan-Africanist and they knew mm-hmm. Ahmed Ben Bella. And, these were the leaders that we wanted at that time. time. And, you know, the United States and the Western powers were ready to get rid of them and then plunge the whole of Africa into the kind of chaos that we've seen, so that you guys can turn your back on Rwanda, where 100,000 people are killed in 8 months and nobody says anything. So I'm a little emotional about this, but, you know, I want you to tell Americans a little bit about the history of what has happened, so that the question you posed about why the United States supported the cancellation of elections that were fair and democratic, because they didn't want to destabilize the whole region, you know, that is the question that we want. And because everybody is angry, I'm angry after being living in this country for 20 years. I'm scared as hell with all our civil liberties getting going and all the terrorism that we have endured since September.
Charles, hang on. I want to bring Philip Naylor in here. Philip Naylor, what about the U.S., Washington's position when Algeria was looking at these elections? Was Washington rash? Was it clearly, was it irresponsible toward democratic principles in supporting the Algerian government in canceling these elections?
Well, I wanted to say, well, first, that Ahmed Ben Bella, when he came to power, did set up a dictatorship. I don't really regard him as a great Democrat. And concerning the United States' position, when the Civil War began, the United States constantly encouraged some type of dialogue, to the point that it had a spokesman for the Islamic Salvation Front in this country, who's still in this country, as far as I know, speaking out. So the United States has always encouraged a dialogue. It has encouraged, I think, much to its credit, a sense of trying to opening up the Algerian system, opening up the democratic, to be much more democratic. And this was the message, I believe, that was given to President Bouteflika last summer by President Bush.
But at that critical moment, we went along with the cancellation of democratic elections. Was that justified?
I think we did, yes. Well, was it justified?
Yeah.
Well, I think given the circumstances in the Mediterranean, given the circumstances of France in particular, I think that we just went along with whatever France was doing at that time, and the French position again was to support the government, though its own support during the 1990s has certainly wavered to the point of being practically inert.
Philip Naylor, stand by. I want to bring into our conversation right now Ambassador Richard Parker. He was ambassador to Algeria in 1974, 1977. He's now a scholar in residence at the Middle East Institute in Washington. Good evening, Ambassador Parker.
Good evening.
Thanks very much for joining us. I hope you've managed to hear a bit of this. We're looking at the example of Algeria as we scratch our heads and think about how democratic reform might blossom somehow in the Middle East looking forward. What lessons do you think we can take, Ambassador Parker, from what happened, what has happened in Algeria as it struggled sort of on the fence between Islamic fundamentalism and democracy and entrenched powers that just don't want to give it up?
Well, as Philip Naylor said, the elections were lost by the Islamic Salvation Front because of the incompetence of the government and the single party, the Front for National Liberation, in terms of delivering services to people, in terms of providing people some outlet for expressing their unhappiness with what was going on, and some means of feeling that they had a say in what was happening. It was not a democratic government. The idea of an election was sort of astounding to people, and that was a democratic idea, but it wasn't going to be a democratic result. Actually, a minority of the people voted for the Islamic Front, but it's because the other party did so poorly in terms of services and turning people out for elections, the Islamic Salvation Front was going to win. It's a question of incompetence.
But this is not the only government in North Africa or the Middle East that doesn't deliver sterling public services.
Well, no, that's true. But they had a lot of money, and it was a wealthy, relatively wealthy country at this point. They could have done a lot more in terms of services and employment, very high unemployment, a lot of people standing up against the wall in the afternoon sun with nothing to do, young men. great fodder for agitation and so forth.
Ambassador Parker, understanding Algeria's story as you do and seeing the current situation with the United States at some point seems may need to suggest whether or not to stand up for democratic reform in other countries in the region. What lessons can we take away? Is it possible to support democratic reform in these countries where so much rage and anger is bottled up without just unleashing chaos?
Oh, I think so, within limits. We have to remember that we can't tell these foreign governments how they're supposed to run their own affairs. This is a matter of internal policy. It's not our policy.
We take that, but, you know, we had Fawad Ajami on the other night, and he was saying that the Islamicists and the autocrats are each so entrenched that without some third party suggesting the United States somehow being involved, this will never be resolved.
Well, I wish Fawad Ajami luck in arranging this. I must say it's very difficult. The Algerians are very sensitive about foreigners telling them what to do. They're very independent-minded, and they're just going to tell us to go to hell. We can advise them. We can suggest. I think we've tried to, as Philip Nader said, we've tried to promote dialogue now for years. We haven't had much luck, but there has been, from time to time, signs of a little movement. I don't know where we stand today, but our ability to influence these matters is very limited.
And I should correct myself. I misspoke. We had Fawad Gurjis suggesting that there may be a third party's involvement required. Philip Naylor, what about the idea of the international community or the United States in particular somehow intervening to encourage, maybe intervening is too strong a word, but encouraging democracy in Algeria and its neighbors in the region? Do you see a way for the U.S. to productively do that?
Well, this was tried over and over again in the 1990s, not only by the United States, but also by the European Union. And the Algerians, as Ambassador Parker knows very, very well, do have this attitude that we do not want anyone to interfere with our own affairs. They fought very hard for their own liberation against a very strong, intense colonial power. And this just has not worked, to the point, as I mentioned earlier, that the government in power today is practically a reformulated government of those that existed before 1988.
Ambassador Parker, we just have a few seconds left before the break, but do you see a path open toward political democratic reform in the Middle East? What is it?
Well, I hope there's a path to it. It's going to be. We thought it was coming 10 years ago, and it hasn't come. And I don't see any immediate prospect of this developing.
Richard Parker, thanks very much for joining us this hour.
My pleasure.
Richard Parker was ambassador to Algeria in 1974 to 1977. He's author of The Politics of Miscalculation in the Middle East. Jack, there's no easy path here. Algeria's example certainly is no bed of roses.
No, but what's different between Algeria and, say, Egypt and Saudi Arabia is that the U.S. government actually has leverage in those other two places. We give Egypt some billions in military aid every year, and we protect Saudi Arabia. That gives us more leverage there to affect the kind of change without which our presence and, indeed, the stability of the region is at hazard.
We're talking about the example of Algeria as an effort to reach democratic reform in a very tough region for democratic reform. You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. You're listening to special coverage from WBUR Boston. We'll be right back. This is special coverage from WBUR in Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook. We're talking this hour about democratic reform in the Middle East and the bloody example of failure in Algeria. You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. Arvin is on the line. Hello, Arvin.
Hey, Tom.
Welcome.
I have a comment. Everybody keeps saying, you know, that you have to force democracy on these countries. There is a very important prerequisite for democracy, for people to accept democracy.
Mm-hmm.
They have to accept a constitution. They have to accept a rule of law. And they have to keep that paramount to any other book that they have been following so far, the Bible, the Quran, or any other book. So unless and until at the grassroots level, people say, well, if it comes to a choice between the Quran or between the Bible and the constitution, I choose the constitution. Unless and until that idea permeates throughout society, it doesn't matter how many billions of dollars America or any of the Western countries spend in that region, there will be no democracy. The only democratic country in the only quote-unquote Muslim democratic country in this world is Bangladesh. So, you know, it's...
Arvind, you really get right to the heart of it. And I want to point out, we're not talking or suggesting imposing democracy, but the cry gets raised that things won't be solved somehow in the Middle East until there is democracy. But Arvind, thanks for your call. And Professor Philip Mailer, I want to put this straight to you. Arvind's suggesting that there's something mutually exclusive about Islam and democracy. Do you buy that?
No, I don't. I think that Islam and democracy do work. As a matter of fact, as I mentioned earlier, Islamic parties have participated in democratic processes. When you look at Iran today, for example, where you certainly have had some important changes in the last few years, these changes have occurred as a result of an Islamist party. And so you have to be, again, we have to be very careful in mm-hmm. making all of these comparisons or creating models here mm-hmm. because of the fact that we have so much individuality. And I wanted to just go back to what Jack was saying about our own leverage in Algeria. We do have leverage in the country when it comes to the Algerian economy, particularly with regard to hydrocarbons. Algeria has the 14th largest oil reserves in the world. And the fifth largest natural gas fields in the world, and the second largest natural gas producer. And we have heavily invested in its infrastructure concerning that particular sector. And in addition, we have also provided a lot of foodstuffs to Algeria. Algeria given its large population, has to import a lot of food. So we do have access here. We do have, you know, some influence. But again, that influence is still limited.
So 10 years after things fell apart, is Algeria any closer to the possibility of democratic reform today?
I have to say today, not any closer, though there is now a constitution, going back to the caller's appeal, a constitution where there is a bicameral legislative system. And also, of course, you have the executive, who is the president. But that constitution was amended to make the president stronger, and it took a lot of power away from the legislature, and this occurred a couple of years ago. So constitutions are not necessarily an answer here at all in Algeria. There are other issues, and as I mentioned before, that issue has to be one concerning political inclusion. Mm.
Political inclusion is what we'll go out on. It's a long trail of blood and tears, but not democracy yet. Philip Naylor, thanks very much for joining us tonight.
Thank you.
Philip Naylor is professor of history at Marquette University in Milwaukee, Washington. He's author of France and Algeria, A History of Decolonization and Transformation. Jack Beatty, there's so much more to get into on this subject, but it looks like a conversation that's going to go on for years as the United States tries to sort out September 11th and its ramifications and where our responsibilities lie politically.
Yes, I think so. And I think, but, you know, this isn't a conversation we were having before September 11th. Everything was just
That's
going
true.
Along as it was. We had our interests, and those interests required supporting these corrupt and autocratic regimes. Well, now we're facing it. You know, terrorism has come from Egypt and Saudi Arabia. I mean, that, you know, their domestic arrangements have helped to produce this. So we have a stake in those domestic arrangements. And we have a stake, for example, in Egypt in saying to them, listen, you are detaining thousands of people who are members of the Muslim Brotherhood. Every time there's a parliamentary election, you arrest them so they can't run. Let them out. Let them run. But, let the system work.
But, Jack, you know, we've heard Christopher Dickey with Newsweek say that the Saudis always whisper in the ear of Washington, you may not like us, we may not be perfect, but you try this democratic thing and you're going to have bloody chaos all over this region.
Sure. And I can, and you know, for anybody who likes stability over all values, that makes sense. But I think it was Stanley Hoffman on our program the mm-hmm. other week who said, today, idealism is the only kind of realism, because we're learning again and again that the rage of people whose governments are not legitimate is building and has been directed against us. So the answer to that Saudi person is to say, well, that may be true today, Prince, but it'll be worse tomorrow if you just let it go.
Can't be
and
ignored.
That has been the lesson in these places.
Thanks, Jack.
Thank you.
You can continue this conversation online. Go to WBUR.org and click on Special Coverage Forums. Across the world, Muslims are observing Ramadan, the month when it is believed the Quran was sent down from heaven.
In the name of Allah, most gracious, most merciful. Praise be to Allah, Lord of the universe, most gracious, most merciful, master of the day of judgment. You alone we worship. You alone we ask for help. Guide us in the right path, the path of those whom you bless, not of those who have deserved wrath, nor of the strayers.
The Quran is the final word and law of Islam. It's also been the focus of great international interest since the events of September 11th. For the next five evenings, we're going to take a close look at the Quran to better understand the bedrock of Islamic faith. Tonight, for an overview of the Quran and its central importance to Islam, we're joined by Juan Campo, an associate professor of religious studies specializing in Islam at the University of California in Santa Barbara. Welcome, Juan Campo.
Good evening, Tom.
Professor Campo, if you would, tell us the story of the origin of the Quran.
Well, the origin story that's most widely recognized by Muslims is that the Quran originates with God. Then it manifests itself in human history during the lifetime of the Prophet Muhammad. And this is between the years of 610 on the Western calendar and 632. In other words, for a period of about 22 years, it's believed that Muhammad received revelations of the text of the Quran from God. And then most widely believed connected with that, it wasn't God speaking directly to Muhammad, but it was through an intermediary, the angel Gabriel.
And for Muslims, what is the role of the Quran? Is it similar to the Bible for Christians, let's say?
The Quran has an all-encompassing significance for Muslims. Most immediately, it defines a daily aspect of their religious practice. Perhaps the most common way in which Muslims first encounter their religion is through the Quran, through hearing the text recited on the radio or in their homes, or seeing the text, because many times Muslims will decorate the insides of their homes or businesses, and obviously mosques, with verses from the Quran, beautifully written in the Arabic calligraphy. Many public events begin with recitations of the Quran in, you know, Muslim societies. And beyond that, then more specifically, the Quran is the basis of many of the principles of belief, worship, and actual law that Muslims will follow.
How about the book? What is its length and what is its structure? Would it be familiar to Western readers as a religious text?
The Quran is very popular these days in the aftermath of the events of September 11th. We have many people going on buying copies to see exactly what does this holy book say and what is it and start to read it themselves. Mm-hmm. And they might find themselves a little bit frustrated in doing that because when they encounter the Quran, it's not exactly the kind of holy book that they might be familiar with coming out of a Jewish or Christian tradition. The Quran is about the length of the New Testament. It's composed of about 6,200 verses. And those verses are organized into 114 chapters. The chapters are not organized according to any kind of story or narrative. There's no such overarching story narrative in the Quran. The Quran basically is organized according to length of chapters. And so you have a general opening prayer, which is called the Fatiha, or opening chapter, and that prayer is a basic element of all Muslim worship. It's probably the part of the Quran that of the 1 billion plus Muslims in the world today that most of them will have memorized.
Mm-hmm.
And then you go immediately from that to the longest chapter of the Quran, chapter number 2 of the Kaw, or Al-Baqarah is the Arabic name for it. As you go along further in the Quran, you go into the shorter chapters. The last two chapters seem to be just short chapters of prayers asking for God's protection from evil forces. So in between, then, you have these other chapters that have these curious names, like the bee or the ant or sand dunes or divorce. And what's happened in terms of the names of these chapters, again, here, the names are not so much connected with the subject matter of the chapter. They're key words, unusual words in Arabic that occur in that chapter. It's basically to facilitate memorization. You memorize something that has an unusual or distinctive name to it, you know, and then from that basis they can recite.
Do chapters tend to have a specific theme or a bit of specific moral guidance to each?
Not in each, no. You have then a number of themes that occur in any of the chapters, and these themes will range from obviously the theme of God's oneness, but you also have themes that relate to human responsibilities to acknowledge God's oneness. to follow his will, to, in other words, submit to him, which is what Islam means, submission to God. Mm-hmm. And then you also have stories that attempt to illustrate that. Those stories are drawn, many of them, from the Jewish and Christian biblical tradition. We have stories about Adam, about Noah, about Abraham, Moses, Jesus. And those stories are meant to make the readers or listeners to the Quran mindful that there is one God who wants people to submit to him, and if they don't, there are serious consequences that can be faced. And then there's a final judgment. This is another key theme in many of the verses of the Quran, where people are rewarded and punished on the basis of the degree to which they're willing to submit to God and recognize his oneness.
And, of course, the Quran, in historical terms, came after the Old Testament, the Torah, after the biblical New Testament. It makes no bones about that. And the introduction of the Quran that I read said, this is God's final message to humanity.
Yes, it's an idea that's actually expressed repeatedly in the Quran, that God has not only sent the Quran to Arabs in the time of Muhammad, but he has sent his revelations to other peoples prior to Muhammad, and the major revelations acknowledged in the Quran are the revelation of the Torah to Moses, mm-hmm. and then the gospel to Jesus.
But in the case of the Quran, the actual Arabic language presentation or fact of it is crucially important. What's that about?
Yes, as I indicated earlier, the Quran is believed to originate with God, and the language of the Quran, therefore, is God's language. It is, in a way, a manifestation of God in this world. And so, therefore, as being the language of God, then that's the language, ideally, that all Muslims should learn the Quran in. Many of them will have Quran tapes, the recited word of the Quran, which is done as a kind of chant or song. Just to hear that beautiful sound, which they regard as a kind of divine sound, to let the space be filled with that kind of divine presence, simply from the Arabic sound of the text. They might not understand what that sound is saying, but the meaning seems to go beyond that, because this is an evidence of God's presence in the world.
Professor Juan Campo, for those of us who are just being introduced to it, can you boil down what are the key lesson or lessons of the Quran? What are the very central core messages of the Quran?
Well, I think that most people who are Muslims and people who have studied the Quran would say that the key message of the Quran is a message that is constantly repeated, that there is only one God and that he cares for all of his creatures, that he is the one that has brought all of this universe into existence and everything in it, including human beings. And out of that care, he's calling them to be mindful of him and to submit to him.
Professor Campbell, may I ask, when you just look at the texts, do you see any reason baked into the Quran that these religions, these cultures, should or must conflict?
Not necessarily. It's a scripture that, as I indicated, had over 6,000 verses in it. And a lot of those verses can be taken and read as promoting a kind of ecumenicism between religions, particularly the monotheistic religions. But there are other verses that come out of a more conflictual context that can be taken and used to promote religious conflict. So I think that you have elements of both in place. And given that, I think it's really up to Muslims to make a decision how they want to present their religion and interpret the Quran in the modern world. Do they want to present it and structure it in a way that represents a spirit of ecumenicism, or are they interested in promoting it as a kind of doctrine of religious war against differing value systems and belief systems? And I think we're at one of these critical moments where Muslims are making decisions on this matter, and many of those decisions have reference to the Quran. They're looking to it for guidance. The Quran doesn't give a single simple answer. It's really what they make of it.
Hmm. Professor Juan Campo, Associate Professor of Religious Studies specializing in Islam at the University of California at Santa Barbara. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you, Tom.
Tomorrow night, part two of our week-long series on the Quran, we'll be looking at the role of God in Quranic scripture. I'm Tom Ashbrook. You've been listening to special coverage from WBUR Boston.